I think what we're seeing in my own country and in the region, in many other places, reflects the deep emotions, the profound feelings that many people have at the suffering that so many people are enduring, and in particular, the innocent children, women and men in Gaza. It's a profound thing, and I not only understand it, I understand why people are speaking out.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at the World Economic Forum in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia over the weekend. As the war in Gaza continues, so too have protests on college campuses across the United States. Nearly 300 students were arrested at various universities over the weekend. Pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel protesters clashed at UCLA yesterday, and we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. First, let's go across town to USC, which has been mired in protest and controversy for weeks now, ever since the university canceled valedictorian Asna Tabassum's commencement speech after complaints from pro-Israel groups. That move and the war in Gaza sparked larger protests, and the LAPD arrested at least 93 people last week. Now, USC has closed the campus to public access and canceled the main undergraduate commencement ceremony. After being cleared on Wednesday, a pro-Palestinian encampment has been reestablished on the campus. So we're going to talk about what's going on there now with Sandy Tolan, professor of journalism at USC and an author of two books on the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Okay, so catch us up to date. This pro-Palestinian encampment is now back after being cleared by police last week.
That is correct. I've spent maybe 7 or 8 hours at the two different encampments. They were relocated back to the original spot at Alumni Park. I was there for several hours on Saturday night, along with about 20 other members of the faculty and I would say a couple hundred students. And it was extremely peaceful. It was rather surreal. At one point, you had a woman standing on a fountain quietly reading the names of people who have died in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza. And she was surrounded by people sitting cross-legged, just listening quietly as she read the names and the ages and if people were old enough, what their aspirations were in life. And meanwhile, all along, there were these helicopters, LAPD helicopters thundering overhead. We had received alerts, which is why a lot of us faculty went down, that that LAPD was poised to enter. And I know that there were credible reports that there were dozens of police cruisers and the police were about ready to enter. And then late that night, maybe around 10:30 or 11, suddenly the tactical operation was called off. And within a couple of minutes, the helicopters just turned and went away. So it was, it was really something to see the people. And I agree in this case with Secretary Blinken that people are speaking their values. They're deeply concerned and outraged by the killing in Gaza.
Right. And so this is, as you say, it was largely peaceful and in stark contrast to what happened last week when the police did come in and arrested 93 people. What was the reason that they came in the first place? Did the administration view the encampments as not peaceful?
That's what President Folt finally said. And Provost Guzman also said in their messaging of last week. But to my knowledge, neither of them has been there. And I and many other faculty members have witnessed many hours of these students, and none of us has seen any violence, any threats, any shouting or screaming other than chanting. And so the idea that these people are somehow a threat is to me absurd. And President Folt, her statements have been really out of touch. I mean, it's clear that she hasn't been there, but not only that, on the day that the 93 protesters were arrested last Wednesday, the only statement she made was a celebration of the return of Reggie Bush's Heisman Trophy. So there's a kind of surreal disconnect going on here. And the idea that somehow students who are speaking their conscience are somehow a threat. I don't know what they are a threat to. A threat really is to free speech. And that's why a lot of us across the campus, even those who might disagree with the facts on Israel and Palestine, are rallying around the students for their right to speak freely.
Well, I mean, some Jewish students have felt threatened. They feel like when they hear chants from the River to the Sea or in places like Columbia, you've had actually more direct anti-Semitic threats to people in particular and in other campuses, that there has been an increase in anti-Semitism on college campuses reported by many, many Jewish students. So are you not seeing that there at USC?
I have not witnessed anti-Semitic remarks myself. That is not to say that there is no anti-Semitism in any of the protesters, but I haven't seen it. And I would say also that everyone should has the right to feel safe and to feel not threatened, whether it's a Jewish student or a Muslim student. And there's a lot of accounts from Muslim students or Arab or Palestinian students where they also feel threatened. Everyone should feel safe, have the right to feel safe. If someone feels uncomfortable because there are protests in support of Palestinians, that is another matter. I do not think that in of itself is anti-Semitic. But where there is anti-Semitism, genuine anti-Semitism, it should be absolutely denounced. And I would also like to point out, Madeline, that, you know, that one of the groups that's been very actively involved in the protests at USC is Jewish Voice for Peace. And there are regular seders there in the evening. There was a Kaddish reading scheduled along with yoga and kite making and Black Palestinian solidarity session scheduled for Wednesday before the police broke it up.
Okay, so for now, at least, the USC administration is leaving the encampments up at USC. It has also restricted public access to the university and canceled, as we mentioned, the main stage commencement address. And now it turns out that a few commencement speakers at the satellite graduation ceremonies have withdrawn, saying that they can't speak because they don't agree with what USC has done. So talk about that aspect of it and how the students are feeling about all this as their graduation day nears.
Absolutely. I mean, it truly is heartbreaking. It's a fiasco that the USC administration could have easily avoided by not canceling Asna Tabassum's valedictorian speech. But you know, I just am so sorry for the students who, many of whom, as you recall, Madeline, didn't get to have a high school graduation during the pandemic.
Right.
Well, they don't get to have a graduation from USC. And imagine the pride of so many, especially first generation students, some of whom had family coming from all over the world, different places all over the world. And to have this canceled, this did not need to happen. And in terms of shutting down the campus, you know, I actually had to figure out a way to get into the campus because I was not allowed to enter the campus on Saturday night. And I told them I had to get some things from my office, which I did. But they prevented the press from coming in, other than the USC Annenberg Media and the Daily Trojan, who have been doing an incredible job of reporting the story. And really, I mean, this is a real education for them. But there were many reporters and television cameras that were not allowed in. I mean, I've reported from more than 40 countries. You know, this is what dictators do. This is what besieged leaders from around the world. They cut off access to the press. This is what people do under martial law. I don't think USC intends to create the impression that it's creating martial law. And I'm not saying it's doing that exactly, but these kinds of restrictions are completely inappropriate, especially under the circumstances of peaceful protests, which might make some people uncomfortable. And again, when it veers into anti-Semitism, which I have not witnessed, then that's another matter. But this is a complete overreaction by my administration.
How do you think they should right the ship at this point? Do you think they can right the ship at this point? And also to point out that USC administrators are not alone in dealing with this and having to come up with policies, it seems, in the moment. This is happening across the country, as we've been reporting. But how do you think your particular administrators should handle this?
Well, like you say, maybe too late. I think, you know, if we could go back in time, they should not have canceled Asna Tabassum's valedictorian speech, which is what really accelerated everything here. I think there's still time to reinstate it. I think they have crossed a river, and they probably won't want to recross it and go back. But I think also there is a cultural relationship here between USC and the Los Angeles Police Department that is maybe part of what the response is, why the response has been so militaristic. There are senior people in the USC administration that are involved with the Los Angeles Police Commission. One even has deep ties to Israel's security and counterterrorism establishment, and LAPD, who has done training over the years in Israel. So to me, that may be part of what is driving this more hardened response. But to me, it's also a conflict of interest. If there was time for them to really reflect on how we got here and reach, you know, with the appropriate tree and olive branch out to everyone at USC, not just the protesters, and say, you know what, we made a mistake. We're going to try to make it right. We're going to put on the graduation again. We're going to have Asna Tabassum read the valedictorian speech. I think that's the best solution. And I have zero hope that at this point that that will happen, unfortunately.
Mm. Okay. And stepping back a bit, taking a wider lens, if you will, you have been a longtime foreign correspondent. You've written two books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict over many, many years. And I guess I'm wondering how effective these protests can be in affecting this conflict.
Well, it's really an excellent and unanswerable question, I would say. You know, I think this is consciousness raising in the old-fashioned way of the 1960s. I mean, you had Vietnam and civil rights protests, and at the time, I'm sure there were people questioning how effective they could be. When you look back, historians look back, and I think people would agree that they have generally contributed to change. Interestingly, I think, you know, when Israel's assault on Gaza in 2014, I think, began to change perceptions of a lot of younger people, especially, including younger American Jews, where the opinions about, you know, just supporting Israel and opposing the Palestinians, that began to shift. I think that is continuing now, and I think there's a huge disconnect and empathy gap, if you will, between seeing Palestinians as human beings and seeing Israeli as fully human, which of course everyone should. But the question of these protesters, I think part of what they're doing is trying to empathize with people who are under siege. And that is a lesson that I think, you know, for these protesters, for the students that are out there, as much as I like my own teaching, I think it's perhaps more valuable than anything I or anybody else would teach them.
Sandy Tolan teaches journalism at USC. He's also author of two books about Israel and Palestine, The Lemon Tree and Children of the Stone. Sandy, thank you so much.
Madeline, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll find out what happened over the weekend at UCLA, where pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian protesters clashed. And later, what are universities legally allowed to do if they want to clamp down on protesters? Our Legal Eagle will be here. Those stories are coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier, we talked about the protests at USC. Now let's go across town and look at what's happening at UCLA. It has been relatively peaceful there today, but over the weekend, there were intense, sometimes violent altercations between pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel demonstrators. Campus officials say a barrier separating the two groups was breached at some point over the weekend. Dylan Winward has been covering this for UCLA's Daily Bruin. Hello.
Hi.
All right. So you were there this weekend. What did it look like to you?
Yeah. So on Saturday, actually, the encampment was fairly peaceful. There was a bit of a party atmosphere, really, with lots of programming going on through the day. But Sunday was when things really started to heat up. So over Saturday evening, there was an attempt from counter-protesters to breach the encampment. That wasn't successful, but it led to kind of the first violent altercation that we've seen at UCLA. On Sunday, there were then four different groups demonstrating on campus. Barriers were breached, and it led to some violence between the two groups. We've reported that there was someone with blood on their face, and one of our reporters got punched as well by demonstrators.
Oh, wow. One of your reporters was just caught in the fray, or was specifically...
Yeah, was caught in the fray when those barriers were breached.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So passions running high. Anyone seriously injured or just minor injuries, as far as you know?
So we're not hearing any reports of serious injuries at the moment. UCLA has confirmed as well that no arrests were made yesterday. But we know that people have had to seek medical attention on site.
Okay. What is the attitude on the part of university administrators? We know it. We saw what happened at USC. They called in the police last week and arrested people. What has been the attitude on the part of UCLA administrators?
Yeah. So we know that UCLA are very keen to emphasize their commitment to allowing students the right to protest and protect their right to free speech on campus. They're keen to emphasize that UCLA, unlike USC and some of the other universities we've been seeing around the country, is a public university. So they've been keen to facilitate that. The counter-protest yesterday in support of Israel did receive a permit from the university to take place. And we're not aware of any plans to break up the encampment. UCLA has stressed that they're not going to preemptively call the police to move on the encampment either. So that's the current approach from administration officials.
So as of now, the pro-Palestinian encampment is still there. How many people are there?
Yeah, it's very hard for us to say because lots of them are in tents, lots of them behind barricades as well. We're currently estimating that there's anywhere between 100 and a couple hundred students inside the encampment. That has been fluctuating. People have been coming in and out to use restrooms, to get food, and in some cases to go to class as well. But we currently estimate somewhere between 100 and a couple hundred.
And how many on the other side, on the pro-Israel side?
On campus, there are a couple of people supporting Israel at the moment. Mainly, they're supervising a screen, which was set up yesterday. The screen's playing footage of survivor accounts from the October 7th attack. We know as well that a GoFundMe was set up and raised more than $70,000 towards that equipment. But the bulk of the counter-protest presence we saw was yesterday when there were thousands of people on campus in Dixon Plaza.
And those people, were a lot of them not students, as far as you can tell?
It's very difficult for us to verify who a student is, but from what we can tell, a significant number of the people on campus yesterday were not students.
Were not students. And what was the nature of the dispute? The pro-Palestinian demonstrators are calling for divestment, correct? Amongst some other demands. And so what is the other side? What are they saying?
Yeah, so the encampment has actually got five different demands. Among them is divestment, the university breaking ties with the LA Police Department, and also an academic boycott of Israeli universities, so a severing of UCLA's ties with those universities as well for things like research. On the other side, the demonstration appears mainly to be advocating just for the university to protect Jewish students against anti-Semitism, which they say has been rampant on this campus. Since October, but also in particular with the encampment, And many of the organizers yesterday were keen to emphasize that their demonstration was a show of support for Jewish students.
What have you reported and your paper, what has your paper reported when it comes to anti-Semitic incidents on campus?
Yeah, so we haven't actually had a huge number of reports of specific anti-Semitic incidents on campus. We know lots of the chants that have been made inside the encampment. People have been chanting from the river to the sea and about Intifada have been labeled by some as anti-Semitic. But we're not aware of any specific anti-Semitic targeting on campus. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. It just means that it's not something that has been passed on to us.
Okay. And so as far as you understand, the pro-Palestinian encampment will remain for the time being, for who knows how long, and the protests will continue, and commencement activities will also continue as planned?
Yeah, so the encampment media representatives are claiming that they plan on staying indefinitely. We've seen no indication from the university that they will be moved on, particularly if they remain peaceful in their intentions. In terms of commencement, that's actually still quite a long way off at UCLA. So unlike USC, we're on the quarter system, which means there's still 7 weeks left until commencement. And university officials have stressed that a decision hasn't been made on that yet.
Okay. Well, 7 weeks is a long time to have an encampment. I you know, so I guess, you know, the students are committed to being there for the long term.
Yeah, from everything we've seen, they are.
Mm. How would you compare what's happening on the UCLA campus to what we're seeing at other campuses, both across town at USC and nationwide?
Yeah, I'd say the main thing is it seems, at least from the outside, that what's happening at USC and nationwide is that the encampments are being disrupted by university officials and by the police. We haven't seen that here. For most of the days that we've been covering the encampment, there hasn't been a visible police presence at all, really. Yesterday, there were 20 officers in riot gear, but they were faced away from the encampment. So that would be one significant difference, I would say. Otherwise, a lot of their demands seem pretty similar to what we've been hearing from students we've spoken to at Columbia and elsewhere across the country.
And what about professors? Are they getting involved in this at all?
Yeah. So we've actually wrote a piece interviewing some professors from Faculty for Justice in Palestine who have been inside the encampment, who've been around the encampment giving interviews. Some of them are generally in support of the right to protest. Some of them more specifically aligned with the issues of the UC Divest Coalition. We're also aware that there's a big faculty demonstration. So we're yet to see how that materializes.
Dylan Winward is UCLA Features and Student Life Editor at the Daily Bruin at UCLA. Dylan, thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yep, our Legal Eagle is here to talk about how much free speech universities have to allow legally. And later, the music producer Brian Eno helped create the sound of David Bowie, Talking Heads, U2, and many other bands.
He was sort of an early pioneer of the use of synthesizers in rock music. But really, it was in the recording studio that he really expressed his creativity.
There's a new documentary about Brian Eno. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been talking about student protests at USC and UCLA. These protests are happening at college campuses across the country. Hundreds of demonstrators have been arrested. Today, 21 House Democrats, including Burbank Congressman Adam Schiff, sent a letter to Columbia University's trustees calling on them to resign if they don't disband the pro-Palestinian encampment on campus and ensure the safety of Jewish students. They say Columbia could be violating Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. We're going to talk about free speech on college campuses and how these schools have responded with our Legal Eagle, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. So as we mentioned, hundreds of students have been arrested over the weeks for various reasons, failure to disperse, illegal encampments, and on and on. So are the universities within their rights to call in the police, disband the encampments, and arrest students who are demonstrating, or do the demonstrators have any First Amendment protections?
Can we say both? So in about an hour, I'm going to go into my review session for my First Amendment students. And the answer is it depends. And so what we're really thinking about when we're thinking about these First Amendment concerns is, first of all, we want government actors, including private universities, and in California, because of a state law, we're also including private and non-religious universities. We want them to make decisions that aren't targeted based on a certain speaker's identity or based on the substance of their speech. And what I'm really saying is we want all university administrators to make decisions that are quote unquote content neutral. So if it was a pro-choice rally, if it was a pro-life rally, they would make the same decisions because they would say we have to clear this space in order to allow students to get to the classroom. And that's kind of the foundational, in my view, the foundational question here, which is, are we sure that the administrators are making decisions that are, again, it's something called content neutral? They would make the decision regardless of who is speaking or what they're saying.
So that's publicly. So they can't publicly say, we are disbanding your encampment because you are calling for Palestine to be free from the river to the sea.
Well, nor should that be the real reason either. I mean, in the sense of they shouldn't say it and they shouldn't act based on that, because then if that's just what they said publicly, that would be a pretext. And I know that there's a lot of discussions, for instance, about USC and the valedictorian about whether or not the safety concerns are a pretext for we don't like your speech. Because again, if we take the USC valedictorian and as I think your listeners know, the fact that USC canceled the speech by the woman who was chosen to be the valedictorian, if the reason is we're honestly concerned about campus safety, then that is a legitimate content neutral reason. And generally speaking, the First Amendment allows that. If the reason is we don't like what we think you're going to say, then we have some potential First Amendment concerns.
Okay, so enter this letter from the House Democrats I referenced earlier that says you need to disband this encampment precisely because of a speech issue, because Jewish students do not feel safe. And it's not just because they are actually physically prevented from getting to the library, but that they have faced discrimination and harassment.
Right. So this is interesting. It's based on, as you said, Title VII. It's a statutory claim. And Title VII very briefly says, you know, in this country, no person shall, and then one of the things is on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from the benefits or be subject to discrimination under a program or activity that receives federal funds. And so what they're saying is the Jewish students are discriminated against and or they can't enjoy the benefits of university programs, programs that receive federal funds. And so they're really making not so much a First Amendment argument, as I understand it, but more of an argument that the protests and the encampments are causing discrimination in a way that violates a federal statute. And, you know, I mean, it really depends on the specifics of what actually is happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I hate to correct my professor, but I think it's Title VI.
Sorry, please. Thank you. I welcome your feedback and corrections.
Okay. All right. So, but one person's harassment and intimidation is another person's free speech in many instances. So how is the university supposed to come down on that?
So I guess there's two questions there. One is intimidation and harassment inside the rubric of Title VI. Thank you. Roman numerals never being my forte. And another is maybe a broader question that you're asking me, Madeline, about when can we actually punish the speech, not saying this is about safety, but when can we look at the speech and say there's something so dangerous about the speech that we're okay making a decision that is, quote, content-based? And so, you know, the first thing I said is, basically speaking, the First Amendment's okay as long as we don't discriminate based on the speaker or the speech. But there's, and I spend weeks talking about this in class, there's a whole host of exceptions, things like incitement, fighting words, true threats. Now, those are narrow exceptions, but if you fall within those exceptions, then it is okay to punish you based on your speech. And those are extraordinary circumstances. And then, you know, to the other part of the question about Title VI, then it really does become kind of a fact-finding mission of trying to use objective factors to determine if there is a statutory violation there.
Do the students who were cleared from campuses, either in USC or elsewhere, would they be within their rights to bring a lawsuit and say, look, your motive really wasn't safety, it was about shutting down my free speech? And under California's Leonard Law, which applies free speech protections to private universities, that was a violation of my First Amendment rights.
I mean, they can certainly bring the suit. I will say that you can expect, let's be honest, that all of these universities are being advised by counsel. That's not to say that if anybody believes their First Amendment rights were violated, then they should be dissuaded from bringing a case. It's just to say that oftentimes you really do have to come forward with evidence that's hard to find. It's hard to find that evidence that shows, no, USC was not truly motivated by safety concerns, because sometimes you need something akin to almost a smoking gun. I mean, and there, I'd be very surprised if there's a memo or a voice memo that says something along the lines of, I think we're fine in terms of safety, but we just don't want her to speak. So let's try and find some sort of reason. Now, of course, that's not exactly what you need in all cases, but you really do need to show that you or your speech was targeted, and that this isn't about just trying to make sure that there wasn't a disruption on campus, regardless of who was speaking or what they were saying.
So would it be easier for, let's say, a hypothetical Jewish student to say, I'm suing you, Columbia University, because you prevented my full access to my educational opportunities under Title VI? Even if you had hybrid learning, that's not the same as a full educational experience that I paid for and expected.
I have to be honest that it's hard to say which one's easier and which one's harder, in the sense that you just need to prove different things. And I think, again, it would really depend on what exactly happened to the students, and do we have any case law that says moving to hybrid is tantamount to being denied a benefit of this federal program. I mean, we talked about this a little bit, Madeline, frankly, when it came to COVID, not in this same legal analysis, but we talked about whether or not there were some suits that people said I was denied, you know, my educational opportunities because I was flipped to Zoom. So it depends on whether or not the students could prove that. And I think it's very hard for me to say one suit would be easier than the other.
Okay, quickly, there's a law professor at UC Berkeley, the law school dean, named Erwin Chemerinsky, and this is a big story, went viral. He had a gathering for his law students and shut down one of the students who gave up and wanted stood up and wanted to give a pro-Palestinian speech. He wrote a piece saying he has the right to do that because this took place in his home, to bar her from speaking, even though this was a school event. What do you make of his argument?
So very briefly, I think the first thing to know is that the First Amendment does not apply generally on private property. Now, if we are to say, and I do think it's a big if, that this is a school-sponsored event. Now, why would we say that? Because the school paid for the dinner, because I think the school sent out the Eventbrite, the invitations. So if it's a school-sponsored event, then we need to try and figure out, does his home suddenly transform into something called a limited public forum, meaning typically this isn't the type of place where you're traditionally open to the public, but because it's a school-sponsored event, we're kind of transforming your private home into a limited public forum. And I think, given what we saw on the tape, the answer is still that he did have the ability to say, I'm sorry, leave.
Okay. Sorry, you're going to have to leave now. The music is here. Jessica Levinson teaches at Loyola Law School. She's our legal. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, music producer Brian Eno has helped create the sounds of legendary musicians such as David Bowie and bands like Talking Heads. And there's a new documentary out about him now. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Look at her laughing like a heifer to the slaughter.
That's Babies on Fire, the 1974 song by the British musician and producer Brian Eno. In his 50 years making music, he has released nearly 30 solo albums. He's a pioneer in ambient music. That's a term he coined, actually. And his methods really influenced many artists after him, like Bjork, Daft Punk, and LCD Sound System. Eno himself may be best known for working with some of the most important names in rock music. As a producer, he helped create the sounds of U2, David Bowie, Talking Heads, Coldplay, Devo, etc., etc. Brian Eno is now the subject of a new documentary. It's called simply Eno, and it's the first documentary about him and his innovative life and work.
When you create something, you're doing this thing that humans are very good at, which is imagining. It's a way of entering another world, looking at its values, seeing how they work out, and that tells you something about yourself.
Eno premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's screening here this Saturday at Glendale's Alex Theater. And joining me now is the director of the film, Gary Hustwit. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
All right. For people who don't know Brian Eno, and frankly, probably most people listening have not heard his name or don't know his name. He's not a household name, even though the music that he helped create, probably everybody does know. But he is a legend. He's 75 years old now. And how did you become an Eno fan?
I think probably in college, a lot of my friends were in bands and I was exposed to his solo records. And then his first band, Roxy Music, I think was really influential among my circle of friends. And then all the bands that he produced. I mean, all the Berlin Trilogy records from David Bowie. I mean, Brian Eno co-wrote Heroes, which I think all of your listeners can sing. Mm-hmm. His kind of stamp has been on so much of popular music over the past 50 years. He's also really known as this creative enabler. I mean, that's why bands brought him in, is because he can sort of disrupt their creative processes, give them kind of new ideas, reframe the challenge. So he's just a super influential thinker and visual artist and musician, and somebody who has just kind of been a creative hero of mine for a while.
Okay, so you use the term creative enabler, which is such a great term. And that made me think of this clip from the movie of David Bowie talking about Brian Eno. And he says he doesn't really know what Brian Eno does in the studio because he says, look, I write all my own music and mix it myself. But it was just something ineffable.
A lot of the recording situation for Brian and myself is sort of a what if kind of situation. It's like there's a lot of play involved with what we do. In the late 70s, when we worked together, a couple of the guys in our band at that time found what Brian and I wanted to do kind of stupid and childish. And I guess they were probably right, but it produces great results.
So that's David Bowie there talking about working with Brian Eno. And as you said, he worked on the Berlin Trilogy, those three albums, Low, Heroes, and Lodger. Can you talk about their relationship and how they met and how they worked together?
I think that they had a very close relationship. They were constantly just, you know, cracking jokes and trying new different approaches to songs. And that's kind of, I think, the secret to their relationship is the humor and experimentation, just freedom to try new things. I think that when Bowie did those records, he was trying to kind of, I don't know, maybe escape. He had been living in L.A. and trying to kind of get out of of the limelight and sort of become anonymous in Berlin. And Eno, you know, was someone who I think there was a mutual respect there, and Bowie brought him in to kind of reinvent his sound. And I think that's what he's done a lot of times with Talking Heads or U2 or other artists he's worked with. He is often credited with giving them a different kind of take on what their music was.
Well, let's go back in time and find out how he became Eno. Eno became Eno. You interviewed him extensively. And in fact, he is the only talking head, if you will, in your movie. I mean, that you interviewed. And there's archival footage, as we just heard. But what did he tell you about how he came to be Brian Eno? Or early on, he was just known as Eno, which seems a little mysterious. But how did he become the producer that he ended up being?
Well, I mean, he, you know, went to art school in England in the late 60s and early 70s at a time when all the fun and all the kind of social change and all the kind of interesting stuff was happening in music. And I think he and other friends like him ended up, you know, forming bands in art school and releasing records. But he was trained as a painter. And I think he often talks about how it was either going to be a painter or a scientist. And I think there are elements of both those things, you know, in his music and just the way he's done things since. He's very analytical. He is very scientific. He's one of the most well-read people that I've ever met. And I think he got into music as a non-musician. He knew how to use a tape recorder because he'd done it in art school. And that's why Roxy Music kind of wanted him to come over to the rehearsal studio to tape some songs. And he became, you know, a member of the band and you know, just went from there.
So, yeah, he was working with Brian Ferry. And then he left the band. And just back then, he was really into this glam rock look, right? He would wear makeup and kimonos.
Totally.
And he looked, you know, he looked the part. And then he kind of ditched that soon after and just, you know, cut his hair and ended up looking like a regular old producer. But why did he decide to leave Roxy Music and kind of leave the onstage world?
The main reason was that he just hated touring. And he often talks about what a waste of time it is spending, you know, 23 hours of the day preparing for 1 hour of the day. And I think he just really wanted to be back in the studio experimenting and recording. In many ways, the recording studio kind of became his instrument. He was sort of an early pioneer of the use of synthesizers in rock music. But really, it was in the recording studio that you know, he really expressed his creativity and then also kind of, you know, expanded that to working with other bands and becoming a producer.
And then he's credits listening to Fela Kuti as a breakthrough moment. He calls it the future of music. He was really taken with it because of this wall of sound. So how did that influence the way he made music with bands like Talking Heads?
Yeah, I think that's more in the late 70s when he, you know, just started listening to Fela Kuti. And, you know, I think it was the beginning of other sort of international influences on rock music. But Talking Heads, yeah, if you listen to Remain in Light, you really hear that influence on like Once in a Lifetime. There's a really dense percussion, and there's also the use of backing vocals in the way that Fela was using kind of brass parts as well.
Okay, so you met your hero when you interviewed him, and I guess you interviewed him at his house in England, right?
Well, I mean, just to back up, like I first approached him about doing a documentary back in 2018 when he did the soundtrack for my previous film. And he said no. He said, like, he hates bio documentaries. He hates music documentaries. It's always one person's idea of the story of this, you know, this subject. And he just wasn't interested. And at the time, I was also sort of experimenting with ideas around generative filmmaking, you know, using software and technology to make a film that was different every time it played. So, you know, we approached Brian with this idea to make a generative film that would be a documentary about him, but that every time you saw it, it would be different. And he absolutely loved it. And that was 5 years ago. And we started working with him on that. So the film that we show at the Alex on May 4th, the people who are in the room will be the only people in the world who will see that version of the film. Because the next time we show the film, it has different scenes, different music. It's different every time. And Brian Eno seemed like the perfect subject to experiment with this idea.
And how different is every version?
Well, there's a couple billion potential versions of the film. The way it works is the beginning scene with Brian is the same in every cut, and the end scene with Brian is the same in every cut. And then there are a handful of scenes that that are in every version that we think are kind of important, or kind of act as little signposts or a structure, a very like loose structure for the narrative. And then in between those scenes, all kinds of things can happen. What connects it all is it's all Brian. And it's like, if you meet someone, the first time you meet them, you know, you learn a few things about them. The second time or third time you meet them, you learn a little bit more about them. And I feel like that's the experience of watching this film too. You get a different picture of this person and their ideas and their creativity every time you watch it.
So that's interesting, because most people would just watch a documentary once, but you're saying you need to watch it more than once to understand who he really is.
To get a deeper understanding, for sure. I mean, it's like you might see the David Byrne scene this time. You might have to watch it five times to see the David Byrne scene. So there's a lot
more. David Byrne scene.
You didn't see the David Byrne scene.
I feel cheated.
Well, it's an experiment. It's an idea. Like, can we use technology to give films a little more agency? You know, we have so much incredible technology now. You know, why can't they have a little bit more capability than just these dumb files that just get pushed to us by streaming platforms? Like, I'm not saying that like linear films are dead. They're still so much amazing work being done. But I think there are other, you know, possibilities that we can experiment too.
Okay, it's a fabulous idea and I love it and I'm intrigued. However, one argument against it is the communal experience, that when you have everyone having their own experience of a cultural product, they don't get to share that with someone else. I mean, in a broader sense, yes, you could say, I saw the, you know, documentary. Oh, I saw it. Well, did you see the David Byrne thing? No, I didn't. What did he say? You know, and then you don't have that shared experience, you know,
well,
complaining about with social media, right? That everyone's in their own little sphere, enjoying their own.
Well, that's why we're showing it. That's why we're showing it in theaters first, because it is about the communal experience in the room, because you're the only people getting to see this version.
I see.
Yes, other people will see a slightly different version and they'll see some of the same scenes, and you can still talk about Brian because there's enough DNA shared between cuts for you to have a conversation of it and maybe see it again or see it again with other friends. I totally agree that the communal part of this is important, but so is getting people to come back into theaters. And I think this makes it an event. You know, like when we do the LA screening, we'll be making the film live in real time on stage. It's not a pre-recorded thing. And it won't exist afterwards either. We won't record it. So it is a little bit more like a performance. I think it's exciting. It's exciting to be in the room and know that you're the only people in the world that are going to get that experience.
Okay, I want to end with one more clip from the film that hopefully everybody will see. And this is where he talks about the power of choirs. And this is a communal experience.
Or just singing together, yeah.
Yeah, or just singing together, and the power of the human voice to connect people. And so this is what he says.
When you have a group of people singing together, there's a level of cooperation and telepathy involved in that. That is so beautiful to hear.
Bring them home from anywhere.
I think singing is the key to world peace, actually. And I have this idea that the more singing groups there are, the happier everybody will be.
Love that. And he really did, even though he is known for being an electronic guru and a machine guy, he really does have this faith in the human voice.
Yeah. And also in the power of music. You know, he talks about in the film that the greatest need we have as human beings is this need to belong to someone. And music is a way that we can, you know, feel like we're part of a bigger thing. Like if you go to a concert, you know, it's not just the music, it's being part of this crowd that's experienced this thing together. And that sense of belonging, it's something that, you know, music gives to all of us.
Gary Hustwit, director of the new documentary Eno, it's screening here in Los Angeles on Saturday, May 4th at the Alex Theater. So you can check out enofilm.com to get tickets and find out more. And maybe you'll be one of the lucky few who sees this one and only version of Eno. Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much, Madeline. Just watching
patiently. And that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again tomorrow. Just waiting. Seasons change something.